Oh, man. I don't know about you. It is so hard for me to sit in my seat when I hear that song. I just want to stand up and dance around and stuff. So I'm telling you, man, they rock that out every service. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to week two of the ID series. I'm Chuck Mingo, and this is Claire Cast. And
hi.
We are officially on this journey, and now it's week two. We're going to be talking about ID theft. Today,
so. Hey, how's your ID group going?
It's going great. We meet on Sundays. We met last week. Had an awesome experience. Great time with the game.
Cool.
And it's really cool. We just want everybody here to be on this journey with us. This might be your first time and you're just kind of taking this all in, or maybe you've been around here and you haven't gotten connected yet. And we're, like I said, on second week of this. So for some of us, this is new. But Claire, for you, this really speaks to some things that have been going on in your life for years now. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm excited for this six-week journey, but I feel like I'm doing the 10-year ID plan. I'm a little bit of a slow learner. I come from a family. Well, we all have, you know, family baggage, dysfunctional families. I think we tended to top the list there. I grew up with in a family with parents, both drinking alcoholically at different points in my life. I have a sister. I have a brother who went through a series of depressions, and probably most important or most critical for me at one point was my sister, who's 5 years older than me. She went through. She had a mental breakdown in her mid-teens. I was probably 11, 12, 13. And my sister kind of hung the moon for me, and so this was a pretty, pretty nasty thing for me to watch. She's, you know, eventually was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, but there was some stuff that went on growing up that just an 11, 12, 13-year-old just really shouldn't be seeing. It was just really, really scary stuff. And so I'm watching all that, and I don't really have parents there that can help me process any of this. So what do? I go, okay, this world is not safe. This world is not a safe place, and I gotta figure out how to, I gotta figure this out on my own, how to avoid being my sister. That's key. I'm not going there because that is scary. So I basically went on this performance path, and that worked pretty well. You know, I started, I was very self-sufficient. And I started going down this path of academics and athletics. And I was getting a lot of positive feedback from that. So I did got good grades in high school, played sports in high school, and I got into a good school, got to play basketball in college.
Wait a second. To be clear, you were the captain of the basketball team at Duke University.
Yeah, well.
A little small school that we might have heard of, so. But this, you said, this was working for you.
Yeah, the school that everybody loves to hate when the tournament comes around.
In March, you're right.
In March, yeah. I mean, I was doing it, and I was on that treadmill, and I'm getting a lot of positive feedback from it, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm not gonna be my sister. And so fast forward to young adulthood, I got a good job coming out of school. And my brother hits his first breakdown. And I think somewhere along the line I figured out that I probably wasn't going to be a paranoid schizophrenic, so I was feeling okay. But then my brother, you know, he went through a depression, and that was really scary for me. And I thought, now I could be that. I could be that. So what do? We get back on that performance treadmill and just kick it up a notch and just go. And always being very self-sufficient and always trying to control everything around me, that was working. It was working pretty well, really. You know, and at some point, I just got tired. The treadmill was just killing me. And I started to, deal with anxiety, like anxiety that I had never had before, anxiety that kind of incapacitated me, that caused me not to be able to think clearly. And when I was thinking, I was obsessing over things. It was just really bad. And the anxiety just kicked me right off the treadmill. Mm-hmm. And I went into a depression. And, I was doing counseling at the time, and we did the little checklist and of, you know, the little depression checklist on, and, you know, he gets to, adds up the score and says, oh, yeah, you're pretty depressed. I'm like, you know, I got my little script, you know, to go get some meds, and I remember getting that prescription filled and pulling that white pill out for the first time, and it was everything that I was never going to be. It was everything that I had fought on my own to never be was what I was about, what I was. And it was just a nightmare.
And what was the message that you heard at that point in time?
You know, the message was just, you the lies that I was believing is you have to work hard, you have to be perfect, and you can't fail. So rely on yourself, control everything you can, and by all means, do not fail. Don't take risks, don't step out of the boundaries, just go straight ahead. And, you know, that's what I had done, and it didn't work. It didn't work. And I remember coming out of a counseling session right after I got on the medication, and it was awful. It was awful. I was just so scared, and I thought, this is it. My kids are going to be visiting me now at the psych ward at the hospital. And you know you're in trouble when the counselor gets up out of his seat and starts pacing. I thought, ooh, this is not a good thing. No, it's not good. So, but something happened in that session. I walked out of there, and it was a voice in me that said, okay, that's enough of that. That's enough of that. And it was like, right then, I felt those fears lifted. And I can't say it's been perfect by any means since then. I still go back to that vomit pile of self-sufficiency and control. But what happened to me during that process, one of the things, was some of the stuff that I was reading in the Bible just started to speak to me, like, unbelievably started to speak to me. Like there was a scripture, I wasn't a memorizer of scripture, but I couldn't help but memorize these because it was just beginning to speak away those lies that I was believing. And like 2 Timothy, I think, it's, you know, God has not given me a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, I like that one. I need to believe that one. And there was other ones. There's one in Isaiah, and it was really basically what Jesus preached when he first came here, and he said, you know, I have come to preach good news. I have come to bind up the brokenhearted. I have come to set people free, mm-hmm. to get them out of darkness. I have come to give them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, and an oil of gladness instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. And I thought, oh yeah, that would be good. Mm-hmm. I like that one.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you'll be called an oak of righteousness. I said, oh man, okay. So, you know, I got to the end of me, and that's when God was able to really begin to fill in me who I really was to him. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that it's perfect. I still go back there, but I understand now who I am in God.
Yeah. Claire, your story is just so awesome because it's exactly what we hope everybody wrestles with over the next several weeks, is just what does that look like in our lives, and where do we go with that? And one of the things we want to do now is check in with some real-time learning, people who are going through the ID experience just along with us and what they're learning early on. We're going to do that. And while we do that, we're going to take up an offering. And if this is your first time here, hey, just sit back and relax. You can let that bag pass you right on by. We're just glad you're with us this morning.
You know, surviving is like, being in a watercraft of some sort and just going downstream. And your whole goal is to make sure that your head stays above water.
As I go through this, I keep finding other areas of my life that I think are just, I have already dealt with and that I have healed from, and I'm finding that I'm just not there.
After our first week in playing the game, we've found out that even though we know each other and we've communicated for a while, some things really came out that we weren't comfortable with or we hadn't explored as deeply as we did going through the ID series in the first week of the game.
I feel like the first 21 years of my life, it was about survival and being independent, just trying to stand on my own two feet and feeling like I was all alone in the world.
Every difficult thing I've gone through, God has used in a really powerful way. So I know in the next 6 weeks, God's going to do something that's going to be difficult and excruciating at times to go through.
Thriving is more living life. It's living life abundantly.
A learning that I've come away with after the first week of the ID series is my want to be a people pleaser. Just realizing that and coming to grips with that has been freeing in itself already.
I feel like the series is coming at a really important point in my life where I'm going to get to stare down some things, both good and bad, about myself, and I know it's going to have huge, huge impacts on some really close relationships in my life, and some of them might be viewed as positive and some of them might be viewed as negative, but there's growth in all that.
Morning. Let me pray. God, you know sometimes our capacity for self-analysis can be never-ending. And that's not what we want this to be. We know that you use that, but we pray that you would use this whole journey as one that we would see you clearer. And by doing that, we would see ourselves and who you created us to be clearer as well. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, last week we started asking this question. You know, maybe a lot of us have settled for a definition of living that's much less than what we were designed for. And, you know, not that we're all in crisis or we all have some massive, you know, movie of the week pain in our past. But nonetheless, even those of us that would feel that things are going pretty well for us, in our quieter moments, we would have to admit that our lives feel a lot more like scrambling, scratching from one season to the next than anything that might be called thriving. And when we look at that, you know, we wonder, why is that? Why is that that even in our stronger moments, we feel that something's been taken from us, and we're not quite sure what it is? And you wonder why that is. Why, with everything that we know today, do we still come to this place where we're much more just surviving from week to week than anything else? I mean, you wonder, it can't be because we're not smart enough. I mean, we are the most educated generation in the history of our planet. You know, it can't be that. I mean, you think, is it because we don't know ourselves well enough? I mean, please, we are the most self-analyzed group of Dr. Phil watching, Myers-Briggs test taking, Seven Habits reading, Oprah TiVoing, Chicken Soup for the Soul eating, Beyond Mars and Venus, Not Sweating the Small Stuff giants that have ever been awakened from within. That cannot be it. That can't be it. There must be kind of more to this whole thing. And I think what's going on is all those things are not necessarily in and of themselves bad things, but they are very cosmetic fixes to a problem that runs much deeper. It's almost as if several years ago, we accidentally downloaded a virus on our computer. And our computer's been running slow ever since. But to answer it, we've answered that by constantly doing upgrades to our computer, buying new monitors, all this kind of stuff, and never dealing with this virus that has ravaged our very operating system. Because all these things, all this self-help stuff, all this learning, all this self-knowledge can be helpful, but not if it's layered on top of a faulty system in the first place. And that faulty system is what we're calling our identity. It's our view of ourself, how we define ourselves and who we are. Now, I know when, you know, start throwing out language like that, that there's a danger that we think that, oh, great, you know, this is going to be one more self-help infomercial, you know, to kind of throw in the mix. So, you know, very early here, I just want to let you know, at the end of this 6 weeks, no one's going to be empowered to buy houses with no money down. You know, that's not where no one's going to be walking over hot coals and smiling, you know, nothing like that. This isn't going to be Crossroads version of I'm okay, you're okay, all right? I've served with a lot of you now for 10 years, worked with a lot of you, gotten to know you. You're not okay, all right? I'll just make that very clear here. Not where we're going. I think, though, that we can tend to think that because there is some common vocabulary. There are some things that jump up in pop psychology that actually reflect some timeless truths from the Bible. And they've actually been sourced from that, not the other way around. For instance, there is this idea that our performance and our relationships, how we act, can be significantly affected by how we think. By how we think about ourselves and how we think about people around us. And that's a very common thread through a lot of pop psychology. But the root of that was some wisdom that God gave us that's laced throughout the Bible. And for instance, in this one place, this collection of wisdom in the Bible, Old Testament, it's been collected within the Old Testament book of Proverbs. In Proverbs, the writer says this about this idea of how we think and how it influences us. Proverbs 23:7
speaking about like the average man, says, for as he thinks in his heart, so is he. And what God seems to be saying here and elsewhere is that how we think, our thoughts, how we process things, how our mind works, how we think impacts the way we act, the way we perform, our relationships with those around us, and our relationship with our Creator can all be impacted by how we think. Now, the problem is that, you know, we tend to think that we are these self-made people. We tend to think that I have formed this identity on my own, you know, in my learning. When in fact, our identities, our very core of who we think we are and what we act out of, is impacted by a lot of information that we receive. We are not blank slates. We get a lot of information, and like sponges, some of that soaks in and becomes part of how we define ourselves. The problem in it is, all of the information that we receive, all of the information we receive is not all true. We receive information in our life, throughout our life, some of which is not true. And if it's some of that select information that gets through and impacts how we think about ourselves, we have a bent identity based on that. And so we end up living out of lies. We believe lies. We believe lies about ourselves. And it's not that we're surrounded by people who are constantly trying to deceive us, although that sometimes happens. But the fact is, very often in our life, lies are passed on to us by just imperfect people who are trying to do their best. And those lies become part of how we define ourselves. Now, the thing is, the challenge in all of this is, we get a ton of information. Not all of it impacts our identity or how we see ourselves. But the challenge is, the key differentiator between whether a piece of information tends to get so embedded into ourselves that it becomes part of our identity, the key differentiator doesn't seem to be primarily whether it's true or not. There seem to be equal amounts of truth and equal amounts of lies that get through. The more stronger differentiators in whether a piece of information is going to impact our identity, there seem to be two things. How early we receive it, and how often. How early and how often. So information that we receive at a particularly early age has a greater chance than average of impacting our identity, and information that we receive very often. And the potent combination is information that we receive both early and often. But the early piece, you know, this is images, this is messages that we get about who we are and what our value is from our parents, from our brothers and sisters, from our friends, from our teachers, from our coaches. If stuff comes at us from a credible source at a very early age, it stands a pretty strong chance of influencing how we think about ourselves. And the danger in that is with very early information, that it tends to cloud how we think about ourselves ever since and how we process future information. In the early principle, I mean, this is why that I could sit across the table from a very successful 40-year-old businessman and he can recount for me the exact words his father used to him once when he was 8 years old. And I can tell you, having sat across the table from a lot of people these last 10 years at Crossroads, that is by far and away the rule and not the exception. Very early information becomes very embedded in our identity. And it's almost like the real challenge of this is that it becomes these kind of lenses, this early stuff, it becomes these kinds of lenses which we process future information then that comes to us. And then the rest of our life becomes a thing of kind of selectively finding information that kind of reinforces that a little bit. It's, you know, like Brian talked about last week with the show Lost. That one of the theories of why Lost is so popular is it's based on this concept that we want to connect the dots. We want to think that random information has a purpose and has a meaning and there's not just kind of randomness to our world. And that's what that's based on, and that's why that's so popular. And so what happens with early information is we get later information in our world and it comes to us and we want that to affirm something that we already believe, even if it's something that we don't like. And so when we get early information, it becomes embedded in us. Later in life, we start selecting information that agrees with that and rejecting stuff that doesn't. It's almost like, you know, imagine that I invite you to a party. I invite you to a party and you're going to know most of the people at this party, but you don't know them very well. We get to the party, we get to the house, right when we get to the door, I turn and I say, oh, you know, right before we go in, I say, oh, You should know, everybody in here thinks you're an idiot. And everybody in here thinks you're a complete idiot. All right, let's go in, you know, and then we go in. Now what happens at that party? What happens when you come in and the host doesn't offer to take your coat? You know why. You know why? They think you're an idiot. What happens the first time somebody's looking at you from across the room? Hey, you know what's going on there. What happens the first time somebody makes a joke about your hometown? You're connecting the dots. You're layering this all onto that information, that lie that I told you before we walked in the party. And so information that you might process another way, you selectively use it to reinforce that lie that I gave you. And that's what a lot of our lives are like. A lot of our lives, we receive some very basic bad information early about who we were, and our lives have become this party that we're walking through, this thing that we're supposed to be enjoying, this thing that we're supposed to find joy and fulfillment and meaning, and all we do is we selectively find things that reinforce that toxic lie we received. And so some of us, we can't even connect all the dots, but some of us at an early age, our mom told, you know, you are impossible. And somehow that stuck with us. And regardless of the amount of good information we later receive, we remember the small little tidbits that reinforce the fact that we're impossible. Or some of us, third grade on the playground, some girl told us we were weird. And that has stuck with us. And we wouldn't like to admit it as a 35-year-old guy, but you remember that. Some of us, very early, people with very good intentions told us, you can be anything you want to be if you just work hard enough. And that's just a big fat American lie. You can't be anything you want to be. You can only be what God created you to be. And so just working harder and harder and harder at something that you're not designed for is not going to do it. So we carry around these things and they become the lenses. And so early information can tend to impact our identity, how we see ourselves. But that's not the only information. There's also the often. The often. You can receive information not early in life, but later in life. But if you get it often, if you get it with a significant frequency from a variety of very creative sources, it can become embedded in part of your identity as well. How often we receive something. You know, this is what the entire industry of advertising is based on. You know, I did it for 9 years. And it's not necessarily that it's all bad, but it's all based on a very powerful principle that we can deliver a creative message to you with great repetition. It will influence your actions. It will influence the way you think and the things that you do. And so when we receive information, very often that can be part of it as well, which is why very smart, educated, self-confident people can at least partially feel like their worth is defined by how white their teeth are. Because they've received numerous amounts of information with a great deal of frequency telling them that that's an important thing. Now, in all of this, the most powerful stuff is that we receive both very early and very often. And that can be a toxic cocktail. One that I've seen, you know, I talk with my friends and I've seen this kind of bubble up in my own life is this lie that's embedded in a lot of our identity that sounds something like this. If I'm going to get my needs met in this life, I'm going to need to pretend to be somebody I'm not. I need to pretend to be somebody I'm not in order to get my needs met. And this is a very widespread thing. I'm amazed, you know, when I started kind of digging this one up for myself, how often I would find this, you know, in conversations with other people. But very widespread also seems to be a very unique kind of human condition. We don't find this, you know, in the rest of God's creation. You know, we don't find this, you know, with animals that, you know, constantly wanting to be, you know, something that they're not. I've realized this in, you know, I've talked about how we were looking for a dog. Well, we got a dog. We've had a dog for about 6 weeks now. Some very generous friends gave us a 2-year-old lab named Moose. And so we have Moose, and awesome dog, awesome dog. It's such a huge gift. But very early when we got him, like the first week, I'm walking him with my son John, and I'm noticing how Moose is trying to get away with stuff when John's holding the leash that he would never try when I am. You know, and I'm noticing this, and I'm telling John, I'm saying, hey, John, you know what? You got to power up on Moose. You know, he needs to know who's the top dog when you're with him. He needs to know who the master is. Otherwise, you know, he's not going to obey. He's going to run out in traffic for his own safety. You got to power up on him. You need to establish superiority in that you're the master. So you need to use a strong, firm voice with him and things like that. So you need to power up on him. So it was a couple days later and I come home from work and John and Moose are laying on their stomachs on the kitchen floor. They're laying on their stomachs. Face to face with their faces about 2 inches from each other. And John is staring Moose in the face and he's got his hands up like this and he's doing this to Moose about an inch from his nose like this. Like, John, what are you doing? What are you doing? He said, Moose has no opposable thumbs and I'm taunting him for it. Yeah. He's establishing superiority at an intellectual level I had never. That's the level of thinking we have going on in the Wells house, I'll tell you. And you laugh as if your 10-year-olds are discussing quantum physics and a Middle East peace plan. Please. Oh, why is that funny? Well, the main reason why it's funny is, you know, Moose could care less. Care less. I never come home and Moose is all frustrated at the keyboard because, you know, he doesn't have a pulse. You know, never trying to work his BlackBerry without thumbs. This doesn't work. But humans inherently have this thing, so many of us, that if I'm really going to get my needs met, I need to pretend to be somebody I'm not. And I'm not talking about growth here. I'm not talking about growing past unhealthy things. I mean fundamentally faking like we're somebody that we're not because we think that's the only way we're going to get our needs met. This last week, I'm still kind of peeling this back. Like during this ID series, I'm still finding layers of this lie that I've uncovered in my own life. We were doing our Thrive Lines in my ID group this last week. How many of you have done a Thrive Line now? Done it? Yeah, if you haven't, in the ID guides that we have for everybody as part of going through this, within the first week, there's a Thrive Line. It's basically just a way for you to chart kind of your highs and lows of your life so far. And to look back on it and to kind of draw some conclusions and see if there's any themes, see if there's any consistent threads. Well, we did ours, and it was great. We didn't do anything else in my ID group this last week. Didn't do the game, didn't do anything. We just went through all our Thrive Lines with each other, and it was really powerful. I was noticing for mine, one thing was college. That season of college seemed to be a particularly critical season for me where a lot of kind of connections happened and certain dials got turned, and that really influenced me ever since. Pretty early in college, you know, as you start to kind of get a feel for how you shake out in the greater world. Now you're out of your hometown, you're at this big campus, you're figuring out where you mix up. Pretty soon I started figuring out, you know, there were some things I didn't do as well as others, but two of the things that I could do was that I could think quickly and I could communicate clearly. And I found that college, I could think quickly and communicate clearly. I had a lot of doors open to me. Thinking quickly and communicating clearly opened, unlocked a lot of doors for me to step through. I had a lot of opportunities based on that. A lot of opportunities I had no business taking because there were other parts of the skill set needed for them that I lacked. But because I could think quickly and I could communicate clearly, I could fake my way into that. And so I found myself with all these great opportunities, And I was leader of this, I was president of this organization, I was an intern for the governor, and all this kind of stuff, all these great opportunities because of this. But I found myself, maybe junior year, maybe early senior year, I found myself with this strange sensation that I was exhausted. Absolutely exhausted. And it wasn't because I was working so hard. I mean, I was working hard, but I've worked harder at other times in my life. But I had this strange sensation of being exhausted because I was spending so much time doing things that I really wasn't wired for. You see, even though, you know, I could think quickly, I could communicate clearly, the other piece for me that I really know about myself is that I'm a pretty significant introvert. I mean, I have kind of a mix. You know, I've described myself as a pseudo-introvert, actually. A pseudo-introvert is I want everyone to like me and then leave me alone. You know, so, and each one of those steps are as equally important, to me. But I, you know, pretty significant introvert. So I found myself doing this stuff that it really took these other things and being a significant extrovert for. Spending all this time with people and all these kind of things. And I found myself being sucked dry by these things. And I realized that I'm not wired to be president of this or, you know, this. But I was faking my way through it because I liked the rewards that were inside that room. I started to call it going where the cookies are. I could see the cookies and this key would unlock that door and I could get in, I could get to those cookies. And I liked those cookies. And so it was a very delicious lie was born in me. That if I'm really going to get my needs met, I need to be pretend to be somebody I'm not. Even if it absolutely sucks my energy out of me. I need to pretend to be somebody I'm not. As a very delicious lie. Now, the thing is that makes some of these lies so dangerous is that some of our lives are very useful. This was a very useful lie for me. This wasn't causing a lot of havoc in my life on a short-term basis. This is a very useful lie. I got a lot of cool stuff and a lot of cool opportunities for it. I got a lot of affirmation, a lot of esteem, a lot of accomplishment. I got stuff for my resume. I got this picture of this security and control and power I was going to have for my life. A very useful lie, and I wrote it hard. I wrote it hard. I wrote it through the rest of college. I wrote it through 9 years at P&G. I wrote it through a lot of promotions, a lot more cookies than I ever kind of dreamed were going to come my way. But at some point, maybe it's, I don't know, about 7 or 8 years into P&G, and I started to question just the level of stress in my life, and it wasn't stress that I was working too hard. It was, again, this familiar stress of spending so much time in these more extroverted related activities pretending to be somebody I wasn't. And I started to question the price that I was paying for those cookies. And as I thought about it, I started to think, you know what? There's parts of me that's been stolen from me. Parts of my identity. I started, what? No, you know, it hasn't been stolen, actually. I have traded it away. I have traded it away, and I started to realize that I'd made a bad trade. That the cost of those cookies, this message that in order to get my needs met, I need to be somebody I didn't. The energy that it was sucking out of my life was a bad trade. And so I started to kind of question this, and I had a community of some close friends around me that I was able to kind of share this journey with and have them affirm or challenge me on different stuff. And I came to the point where I realized, no, I've created this thing that's not me. I need to step into a role that is me. And I started to have those conversations with my management and with my vice president. And they didn't always go so smoothly. I remember one conversation in particular, they got pretty frustrated with me. And I remember them saying, they said, but you don't understand. If you make this change, you will never be king. You'll never be king. I remember thinking, well, I don't know if I'll end up being king anyway, but I don't like the price of that anyway. And it's not that there's anything wrong with being king. Some people are wired for that. But the price that I'm going to have to pay to get the king's cookies are not something that I'm interested in. I'm not interested in making that trade anymore. And if I need to leave to do this, I will, but I don't want to. And as it kind of panned out there, even in a big corporation, they were willing to respond to that thought. We designed a new job there that kind of fit who I was. And you know what? It had less esteem. It had less promotions in line with it. It had less rewards all with it, but it was right within my sweet spot of who I was. And then that was the journey that eventually grew into me leaving there and doing what I'm doing now. And I lived happily ever after. End of story, right? Not quite. Not quite. See, after I joined Crossroads, we started the church and started to grow. And within the first couple of years, the more we grew and the faster we grew, the more phone calls I got. And the phone calls would tend to sound something like this. Hey, Brian, when are you going to do your own thing? When are you going to be senior pastor? You see, there's this role that's open here. You might want to think about, when are you going to do this? You know, what's your timing? And not in all of them, but in a lot of them, the assumption there was this assumption within the church world that basically said, if you're really good, you're either a senior pastor or you're waiting for the right opportunity to be one. And so I started to think about that after a while, after I get these phone calls. I started thinking, well, you know, it would feel kind of good to be able to be the one who makes the final call. It would be nice to be able to have the end control over things, to be able to better control the direction of an organization, have that kind of buck stops here control. That would be good. And, and then I thought, well, hey, the cookies. I mean, come on. I mean, I don't know if you know it, but Brian Tome makes more money than me. We live in an unjust world, folks. No, it's, think of I was like, well, you know what? And then I started, and especially now after 10 years of this, and working as close as Brian is, there's so much about that job I would absolutely hate. Absolutely hate. You know, when you start using the word synonymously, crap instead of ministry, you've got a problem. Oh, I have to go do this crap at 3 o'clock. No, oh, it's ministry. I'm sorry. I have to go do this. Yeah, there's so much of that I wouldn't like. But I started to think, you know, but hey, I could think quickly. I could communicate clearly. I could do that. And yeah, a little part of that I would need to fake. I could do that. And I felt, what am I doing? It's that same lie bubbling up again, but now it's got a nice spiritual coat of paint on it. And I realized at that moment that useful lies die hard. Lies that have been very useful for us, that have gotten us certain rewards, they die very hard. And I started thinking about some of the choices, you know, that I was thinking about making. And around that time, I remember going back through, and in this Bible study, I came back across this verse in Colossians in the Bible, which is the Apostle Paul writing. And he's talking about this thing of how we need to live our lives. And it's Colossians 3:23. And in it, Paul says, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men. And I felt like God telling me with this, Brian, I want you to be fully engaged in something that you can bring all of your heart to, that you can bring all of your fullness to. And I felt like God telling me, Brian, this is a personal thing. This isn't just you. This is about your relationship with me. I have no use for even a little sliver of fake Brian. But I need every bit of real Brian. And I felt God challenge me on that and say, that's what I need. I need your fullness. I need your wholeness in this. And so I found that lie had bubbled up once again, and I needed to deal with it. That the fullness and the wholeness that we are called to does not call us to be somebody that we're not. Now, we may need to grow in areas. That's not saying that's a get-out-of-jail-free card for any kind of bad choices or sin we have in our life. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is fundamentally who we are and faking like we're not. Just to get the cookies. So during this series, you know, this series is not primarily about telling you exactly what to think about yourself. Although we hope that you'll discover from your Creator's words in the Bible during the series how he feels about you. What this series is about is getting you to not have any unexamined assumptions about who you are. Even not having any unexamined assumptions about your identity and where that's come from. And maybe for you, you'll start to discover, maybe for you it's that same lie that I had, that I need to pretend to be somebody I'm not in order to get my needs met. And that's been a very useful lie for you because it's brought you a lot of very good things. Maybe for you, you'll find out it's a different lie. Maybe for you, what you'll discover is that you, at your core, you believe, I am who I am and I cannot change. I am who I am and I cannot change. And that's become a very useful lie for you. Because then, if you are what you are, you cannot change. You don't have to do the hard work of the struggle of actually changing. It's been a very useful lie. Or maybe for you, you'll discover during this that at your core, you believe that you need other people's approval in order to be happy. And that's been a very useful lie. Because if you need other people's approval in order to be happy, these seasons of one misery to the next that you pass through, those are all other people's fault, not yours. Or maybe for you, at the core of your identity is that you're a victim. And it's based on a piece of truth, that at one point in your life, you were victimized. And that is just painfully true. But that's become your identity if that's how you see yourself as a victim. And that's a tough one to get over because that's become a very useful lie. Because if you're a victim, if your identity is that of a victim, then any act of rebellion, any series of unhealthy choices are all rationalized and all justified. Because you're a victim. I don't know what it is for you that you will start to uncover. I only tell you that what we need to do is we need to bring these things up in light and examine them and see how they compare with truth and try to be objective about these messages that we received. So the question is obviously, how do you do this? How do you do this? Well, you know what? The world gives us several different models that are kind of the most popular on dealing with this kind of stuff. One of them I would call the positive thinking model. And the positive thinking model tells you just think better. Think smarter. Think better. Think happy. You know, and you get some happy mantra you can kind of recite to yourself, you know, at a moment of stress. So the positive thinking model just tells you just think clearer, think better. I have a friend, I hope I'm remembering this story right. I have a friend who told me this several years ago. His sister was, I think, getting ready to get engaged, close to being engaged to this guy, a really serious boyfriend, but the family hadn't met him yet. So she, for the holidays, she brought him home, brought her boyfriend home to meet the family, all the extended family for the first time. And so the first night that she's home for the holidays with her boyfriend, everybody's meeting him for the first time, they decide to play Pictionary. Pictionary. And it's a fairly competitive family. So they're playing Pictionary, and his sister and her boyfriend are on a team by themselves, and they're not doing well. They're getting crushed. And the boyfriend is particularly competitive. And he starts to get frustrated. He starts to get frustrated by his girlfriend's inability to pick up on the very lucid clues that he's giving her, you know? And he's exasperated. And on this one clue, he is so exasperated. He's given her all the exact perfect clues and she's still not getting it. He can't take it anymore. He's exasperated. And he stands up and in the middle of all the extended family, the moms and dads, the grandmas and everybody, all this family that he's meeting for the first time, he finds himself standing over his girlfriend, pointing and screaming, "Think! Think more clearly! Think more clearly!" I don't think that relationship kind of worked out in the end. You know, would that help? Does that help? For us to be just told, think more clearly. Think more clearly. Have somebody standing over us, think more clearly. You know, those kind of messages do not do a great deal of good. You know, it's like, you know, I just pass on just a little tidbit from a married guy, okay? If you're in a discussion, let's just say hypothetical, okay? You're in a discussion. Wow. You are in a discussion and someone is getting really worked up in that discussion, saying to them, "Stop getting so emotional." Doesn't do the trick, okay? I don't know what does do the trick, I'm just telling you that one doesn't, okay? Just know that. It's proven. Having people tell you, you know, think more clearly, that's a very limited value. That's the positive thinking model. There's also the religious model. The religious or the moral model. And what that would tell you is just do better. Just do better. Stop making stupid choices. Stop making unhealthy choices with your life. Just do the right thing. And this model can be somewhat useful, and it's somewhat deceptive because it actually can result in somewhat of an improvement in our performance. The problem is, over the long term, the religious model, pretty much the main result is maybe a little bit better hygiene in our life and a whole lot of shame under the whole thing. The religious model just tells us, you know, just do better. And then maybe the most popular one today, I would call it the therapeutic model. And the therapeutic model says what you need to do is just dig stuff up from your past. Therapeutic model says that if you find stuff in your past and you examine it, you'll be healed. What you need to do is just dig stuff from your past and examine it and you'll be healed. And this often can result in us, you know, going to darker places rather than to places of light. Now the thing is, all three of these have some truth in it and they all have some merit. But the problem is they are cosmetic changes and not starting from the place of dealing with the core virus at the root of it, at the identity level. And so all these things, you will see uses for all three of those and where we're going. But they need to be expressions from the start of a foundation. For instance, here, when talking about these things, of these lies, here's what the Apostle Paul says, and this is in the Bible, in the book of 2 Corinthians. And in 2 Corinthians, he's talking about these things and what we do with them. He says, 2 Corinthians 10:15. Or 10:5. "We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ." We demolish arguments and every pretension, every lie that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. Every belief we have that sets itself up against what our Creator says, we bring those out and we take captive every thought and make them obedient. And so the first step in this thing is just simply to not have unexamined assumptions about our identity, who we are. It's just to bring them up and then compare them to what our Creator says about us and then just come to our own conclusions of how much those are based on reality or how faulty they are. So that's what we're going to do right now. There are some very common, as I've found in these last 10 years, there are some very common lies that we're carrying around with this baggage. And they're interesting because they are just blatantly opposed by the things that God says about us in the Bible. And so I'm going to read some of those to you. And one of them, I would say, probably one of them in particular is going to stick with you. And it'll stick with you because it'll just penetrate you and be like, oh yeah, I know that's been me. Or it'll stick with you because it ticks you off. And whatever that it is, whichever one of these stick with you, I just want you to kind of write it down, file it away in your head, and I want you to bring that lie to your ID group this week. So what I want to do is I want to speak some of these lies to you, and I want to immediately counter each one with what our Creator has to say about us. We want to take captives these thoughts and start making them obedient to what our Creator says. Would you close your eyes, please? The fact is, when lies are brought into the light of truth, they scatter. They scatter like roaches in a room when the light is switched. Truth makes lies scatter. Some of us believe that I am what I am. I cannot change. Yet our Creator tells us, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. Some of us are limping through this party of life believing that if I do the right thing, if I make the right choices, life will be easy. But yet Jesus himself told us, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble. Some of us believe at our very core, if I feel it, it must be true. If I'm feeling it, it must be true. But our Creator tells us in the book of Jeremiah that the heart is deceitful above all things. That feelings can lie. Some of us are married and it is not what we thought it was going to be. And we believe that if my marriage is hard, I must be with the wrong person. When God speaks to us through the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians and he says, those who marry will face many troubles. Some of us believe I can't be happy unless things go my way. My happiness is contingent upon things going my way. Yet in Philippians it says, and the Apostle Paul, who is no stranger to problems and darkness, says, I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I've learned the secret of being content. And some of us believe that if I can't explain it, if I can't understand it, it must not be truth. We believe that everything in life can be explained. When our Creator speaks to us, from his words in Isaiah, and he says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts.
God, I know that you have wired into each of us that cry, that pull me closer. We want to know you. We want to know who you are. And ask that this week you give us the strength and the courage to listen to you and to listen to what you have to say, and to just seek you this week, to open ourselves to you, and whatever you want to say to us, that we would receive that. Thanks for this time. Amen. All right, enjoy your ID groups, and we'll see you next week.
Well, I realized I was never going to be the caliber of dancer that I was seeing these kids live up to. And so I started thinking of ways that I could be impressive to Amanda.
So welcome to The Blur. The Blur is Crossroads' weekly podcast, which is all about blurring the lines between what happens in the building on the weekend at Crossroads and what happens in our daily lives as we're interacting with work, family, friends, whatever. And this week, we're going to talk about lies and how they can infiltrate our life at a very early age and then continue to haunt us for many years to come.
Well, I think the big lie that we tell ourselves is that if we can get people to admire us all the time, then we'll be happy and we'll be fulfilled. I even think that people go into relationships based on admiration.
So welcome to The Blur. Recently, I had to go over to Circuit City to pick up some kind of little gizmo thing, which is common for me. And I went into the store and I found what I was looking for. And I went to the cash register to pay for it. And I was going to pay with a credit card. So the cashier told me to go over and swipe it on that little pen pad device. So I did. I went over, I swiped it. And then the pen pad told me to sign in the box. So I took the little stylus and I saw my hand. And I felt the pen in my hand, and I even felt the pen touching the keypad device. But in no way did what I was doing with the pen match the squiggly line that was showing up on the pen pad. And I turned to the cashier, and I said, what am I supposed to do with this? Because it doesn't look anything like my signature. And the cashier said, don't worry about it. And I thought, why do we even sign these things anymore? I expected somebody behind me in line to, like, pat me on the back and say, oh, you poor special man. Because my signature looked like this giant squiggle thing. And, you know, I think that sparked something in me. I think that for a lot of my life, I have moved through my existence without really ever thinking about cause and effect. It's like I see these things going on around me, just like I see this pen in my hand, and I see the motion of my hand on the pen pad, but what I am seeing in no way correlates to what I am doing. And I think that for a lot of my life, I have moved through my existence without really thinking about how things that I decided years ago may be affecting my existence today, or things that other people have said to me that have become absorbed into my identity that now affect the very way that I go about relationships, work, family, whatever. It's just become absorbed into how I think about myself to the point that I no longer can discern cause and effect in my life. And really, that's what we're about in the ID series, is starting to uncover and unearth some of those cause and effect relationships in our life that have led us to where we are today. And hopefully, once we get to the core of them, to not only extract them, but to hold them up and say, God, is this true or is this not true? Well, one of our frequent podcast contributors, Dave Eberhardt, did some thinking about this in relation to some of his early childhood experiences. And here's what he came up with.
It was in fourth grade that I figured out how the world works. See, fourth grade is when I met Amanda. Amanda was about 6 inches taller than I was, and she had long, wavy brown hair that reminded me of macrame. Amanda. I wonder what ever happened to her. Well, I can tell you what I remember. I remember that I wanted Amanda to like me. One of the things about fourth grade was that it was a terrible winter and we weren't allowed to go outside for recess much. See, it was so snowy and cold that it was dangerous, and so we had to stay inside. Well, some kids started bringing their records to listen to on recess, and wow, some of those kids could actually dance. I mean, like teenagers. It's a big deal for a 9-year-old. Well, I realized I was never going to be the caliber of dancer that I was seeing these kids live up to. And so I started thinking of ways that I could be impressive to Amanda. I already had it against me that I was small, and I couldn't dance, and I couldn't even go outside to show off because we weren't allowed to go outside.
Aww.
Well, a few months went past, and I got the news. One of Amanda's friends told me that Amanda liked me. Well, I did what you're supposed to do in these situations. I asked Amanda to go with me. And so I did this through the proper channels. I sent her a note that asked her the question, "Will you go with me?" And I even provided her a list of answers to choose from. There was yes and no and probably maybe, and they all had little check boxes next to them. Well, she sent back the note with the box checked yes. And so for a week we were going together. Now, we didn't actually spend any time together or talk to each other. I mean, at best, we might have looked in each other's direction once or twice. But at the end of the week, the relationship ended the same way it began. I got a note, and it said that the relationship was over. I was crushed. I mean, I really thought we had something special, Amanda and I. I guess it just couldn't last. Well, if this first heartbreak of mine did anything for me, it only cemented it in my mind that I needed to do something for which I could be admired. It wasn't too long after that I started taking guitar lessons, and I worked really hard at it. All through junior high and high school, I didn't spend a lot of time doing social stuff or, well, homework. I spent most of my time practicing guitar, and by the time I got to college, I was pretty good at it. And for a while, I even made a living at it. One of the things about being a performer is that when you do a great job, people tell you you did a great job, and that's nice to hear. Well, after doing this for a while, you realize that the compliments on your performance, it's nice, and it's brief, and it's an awful lot like when somebody compliments you on the shirt you're wearing. They say, "Hey, great job," and you say, "Thanks." Or they say, "Hey, that's a nice shirt. Where'd you get that?" And you say, "Oh, I got it at whatever store." The relationship based on admiration ends right there. It's finite. Well, I think the big lie that we tell ourselves is that if we can get people to admire us all the time, then we'll be happy and we'll be fulfilled. I even think that people go into relationships based on admiration. I know I have. I tried to build up a list of impressive things that I can do or abilities that I have or knowledge that I have on certain subjects. And I meet people and they're impressed by that and I'm this novelty in their lives for a short time. And then it just stops right there. I think unconditional love is one of those hair trigger subjects. We say, "Oh yeah, we get that. We understand what that means. We know about that. We talk about that. That's good stuff." But I think we routinely trade it. One of the things I can tell you with certainty is that if you set out to be admired, you will probably accomplish your goal. You will probably impress somebody into liking something that you do, but you might not have a real relationship there. It's sort of like the vase at your grandma's house. It sits in the corner, and you're not supposed to touch it or use it for anything. You're just supposed to admire it. You're supposed to look at it, and the kids aren't supposed to play anywhere near it. Eventually, the people who live in the house, they don't pay any attention to it, and the regular visitors don't pay any attention to it either. You just know that you're not supposed to handle it or have contact with it or use it for its intended purpose. Now, sure, you can be an asset. People will want to handle you or possess you. You might even become negotiable. You can be traded for something. But you are so much more than an admirable commodity. And so this whole thing has me thinking about my relationship with God. See, I can admire God easily. I can look up in the sky and see this bright sun or an inspiring moon or twinkling stars, and I can say, "Hey, God, nice job. That's cool stuff up there. Great. Keep up the good work. Now that I've told you how great you are, here are some things I'd like you to address. First of all, I got this bad shoulder, and this relationship could use some work, and, well, my job situation, that could use some improvement, and the car needs brakes. So, God, please meet my needs in the following ways, because you perform such wonderful tasks," and, wait, perform? Boy, this sounds awfully familiar. This is the very thing that I hate when people talk about things that they admire about me. That's not who I am. huh, maybe these things that I talk to God about aren't really who He is. I mean, He's certainly capable, He's certainly done wonderful things, but He's so much more than that. Maybe there's another way that I can get to know Him better. I know that I'd sure like to be known as a person. Maybe I should spend a little more time getting to know God as a person.
Dave Eberhardt is a musician, writer, and a regular contributor to The Blur. He actually wrote our theme music, but just don't tell him you admire him for it. Well, that's all for this week. If you have an ID story that you'd like to share on your own or from your group, then you can do so by emailing it to mystory@crossroadscommunity.net. Next week on The Blur, we're going to talk about what we do once we've uncovered lies in our life and how to replace them with truth. Have a great week.